Here's a quote for you. The ultimate measure of a man or woman is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. That's Martin Luther King. Many other people have said pretty similar things. But we know that to be true, don't we? Where moments of pressure, whether that is expectation or illness or pressures at work, different things, when they come on, they have a way of actually revealing what is on inside and the things that have been kept hidden actually come to the surface. But what I find really interesting is when you see a whole group of people put under the same pressure, and again you see how different people respond, who sinks, who swims. In the passage that we're looking at today, most of Luke chapter 22, we find Jesus and his disciples under pressure. It's Thursday, the day before Jesus' crucifixion. It's the Passover, or the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Jewish celebration of when God rescued his people from Exodus. And the anger towards Jesus has peaked. Through the gospel, the tension between Jesus and the Pharisees and the religious leaders have just risen and risen and risen, and it's reached fever pitch. They are desperate to kill Jesus. They are just trying to find the right way to do it that won't upset the people. We're going to cover almost all of the chapter. There's far too much in there, okay? There's a long chapter, the reason being basically because I wanted at our church to have a really neat run into Easter through Luke's gospel. And actually, it's worked out not bad, but it did mean we did some pretty big chunks. But the aim of this chapter is we're not going to dive into all the details. I really want us to approach it with a big picture view. We're zooming out. I want us all, as it were, to journey back to Jerusalem those 2,000 years ago, put us there, and survey all that happened. And we're going to see the remarkable difference between Jesus and the disciples. That's really what I want us to see. I just want us to see the difference between Jesus and the disciples. And as we see the complete dismal failure of the disciples, that is then going to highlight the beauty of Jesus and his unrelenting commitment in saving his people. And as we see the disciples' failures, I think we're going to see our own too. But although I do want us to examine our hearts, ultimately what I want us to do is to fix our eyes on Jesus this morning. The Jesus who never lets his disciples go. So we're going to see five differences between Jesus and the disciples. Can I have the next slide up? Here's the first one. We find a determined saviour and a betraying disciple. Okay, the religious leaders finally strike gold. They can do away with Jesus because one of Jesus' 12, one of the disciples, Judas, whose name has become synonymous with betrayal, Judas agrees to betray Jesus. And the leaders, well, they are delighted. If you can cast your eye, we're going to cover a bit before we read as well. So chapter 22, verse 5. And you see, they were delighted and agreed to give him money. We're not told of Judas's reasonings here. Why did he do this? I mean, greed does seem to be a factor, given that they gave him money to do so. In verse 3, actually just before that, we read that Satan entered Judas. And so we see Satan's work here. And yet Judas is still fully responsible for his actions, as we're going to see later on. But here the plan is set. Judas is going to betray Jesus to the religious leaders so they can kill him. But then the scene switches back to Jesus and the rest. And despite this growing darkness, Jesus is in complete control. He sends Peter and John to go and get things ready for the Passover meal. And then the time comes. They sit down at this meal, and we read this lovely sentence in verse 15. And he, Jesus, said to them, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." See, Jesus knows full well what is happening. He knows full well what is going to come. He knows the time has come, and yet he has earnestly desired. There's a really strong word in the original. He's deeply moved and really wants to have this meal with them. The Passover celebration you probably know, but it's the celebration of God's greatest act of rescue in the Old Testament. When God brought his people out of slavery, bitter, hard slavery in Egypt, and how he rescued them, redeemed them, brought them out of of slavery, and then crossed the Red Sea, and then took them into the Promised Land. It's really one of the highlights of the year for the Jewish people, that this Passover celebration. And Jesus really longed to celebrate this with his disciples. But as we read, we get a sense, actually, that this is the end. So in verse 16, Jesus says that he's not going to eat this meal with them again. It's the end, but it's also the beginning. It's also the start of something. Because no longer are they going to be remembering the Passover. Instead, actually, they're going to be remembering Jesus and his rescue. And so, we have the next slide as well there, verse 19. And he took, Jesus at the end of this meal, he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." You know, what we know as the Lord's Supper. Jesus took the bread and said, "Look, this bread is the picture of my body. This body that the next day is going to be hung on a cross." And so when those disciples and when we take the bread and we eat it, we remember how Jesus gave up his life, suffering in our place. And then, verse 20, in the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." You know, that dark red wine, picture of Jesus' blood. And you remember from the Exodus story how God's people were kept safe by killing the Passover lamb and painting the blood on the doorframe. And they were kept safe from God's judgment as they sheltered under it. And so when we drink the cup, we remember that we are safe from God's judgment because Jesus was sacrificed for us. So it's this lovely scene, Jesus celebrating this Passover meal with his disciples as he explains the new significance that it's going to take on. And it's really poignant because he there is serving the very men who are going to fail him that night. In different ways. But it's significant because he is therefore promising that his sacrifice is going to cover their betrayal, their cowardice, and their denial. This is good news for us too. I think it's so comforting to know that Jesus is not naive about you and me. He knows the compromises that we're going to make. He knows the half-heartedness, the hidden sins, the ways that we're going to disappoint him today and indeed tomorrow. And he still says, "I've earnestly desired to eat this meal with you." He still provides a way to be forgiven for those things. But we are left on a bit of a sour note at this meal. Because immediately, Jesus goes on to say this in verse 21. "But the hand of him who is going to betray me is with mine on the table." The one who's going to betray him is even sharing this dish with him. You know, pretty much every single society throughout all of history, to betray someone you're having a meal with is the greatest horror. And unsurprisingly, it left them all wondering who's going to do this. So that's the first contrast we see, this betraying disciple and yet steadfast Jesus, who knows what's going to happen, and he goes on ahead. Second one, I've got the next slide there. We find a serving king and proud disciples. So having wondered who was the worst of them, like who was going to betray Jesus, who is it? Who's the worst? Who's going to betray Jesus? Almost incomprehensibly, they then start discussing who is the greatest. Do you not go, how? How do you get there in conversation? And I think it's easy, well, I imagine you are as well, you're looking down on the disciples. It's easy to look down on them. But surely, if we're honest, we probably do see those impulses in our own lives too. Yeah, we can all think of the people who are obsessed with performing better than everyone else at work. Got to be better than them. And everyone's got to see that I'm better than them. if you do it yourself or very commonly through your children. You know, we have this deep longing to be recognized as extraordinary. It's just most of us are probably better at hiding it than this. We're far too proud to argue out loud. Jesus rebukes their pride. You know, wanting to be recognized as the greatest, by and large, well, look, that's how leaders in our world operate. Back then, we could probably say today too. And so, verse 25, Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors." But, 26, "but you are not like that. And not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, that is, those of least significance, and the one who rules like the one who serves." But Jesus says, real greatness, it's not wrong to want to have greatness, but he's saying real greatness, well, that is leadership, and real leadership is humility and service. And Jesus takes an everyday scenario, and verse 27, "For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves?" You know, we will say the person who's at the table, right, they're the greatest, yeah? The other people serving them, they're the greatest. But then he points to himself. Oh, sorry, he even says that. Is it not the one who sits at the table? "But I am among you as one who serves." Jesus, right from his humble birth, all through his ministry, to his upcoming death, Jesus served. And that is true greatness. Jesus served. And then in the midst of this crazy conversation, but do you notice the grace that come in verse 28 to 30? Because we might have expected Jesus just to be like, just a rebuke, right? You've got it so far wrong. Like, stop it. Turn, got to go think the complete opposite. And he does that. But also, he says, verse 28, "You are those who have stood by me in my trials." I think that's a really generous way of looking at things from Jesus. They've often misunderstood, they've often stumbled, and yet he sees and he honours the fact that they're there sticking with him. And at the very moment that their pride is exposed, he also promises them in verse 29 and 30, he promises them a place in his kingdom, at his table where they're going to share in his rule. And what grace, what undeserved kindness, as there they are, arguing about who's the greatest, when the very next day Jesus is going to go to the cross, and there they are. And yet he says, don't worry, you're going to be with me. Doesn't minimize their sin, but also he doesn't discard them again because of it. And again, I think this cuts two ways for us. Doesn't it challenge and cut through that craving for status that we have in church leadership of every area, every level, in service? Now, here's the call not to chase after titles or applause or recognition, platforms, but actually it's to take the lowest place, the hidden place. Greatness in God's kingdom, it looks like stacking chairs, visiting the lonely, seeking to encourage them, teaching the children, those unseen things, unseen ways. That's greatness in the kingdom. So it does challenge again and confront us, but also again, doesn't it comfort discouraged servants? You might feel like your service in church is very small, very insignificant, very unimpressive. And yet Jesus sees that weak, fumbling faithfulness of his disciples and says, "You're mine, you're with me, you have a place at my table." But again, we see this contrast, don't we? The humble king and this, who is so astonishingly kind to the proud disciples. Thirdly, the next one, a praying priest and precarious disciples. Jesus turns to Peter, verse 31. "Simon, Simon," using his old name before it was changed, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat." The next slide, Satan wants to shake Peter and the others to pieces. You know, a process of sifting wheat, kind of getting the good stuff and getting rid of the chaff. And Jesus says, look, Satan is longing to unsettle those disciples, to bash them around and to cause them to be unfaithful. Interesting. But the decisive word here is not Satan's demand, but it's Jesus' prayer. That Satan has asked this, verse 31, but verse 32, I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And indeed, not only is Peter going to survive this, but he'll have a role in strengthening others. He goes on, and when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. Jesus has prayed for Peter, and that is one of the things that Jesus did for his disciples back then, and that's what Jesus does today. He lives to intercede for his people, praying for us. Peter, we know Peter, quick to speak, slow sometimes to think. But Peter, of course, he's super confident in himself. He says, look, Jesus, look, I'm ready to come with you and do whatever. I'm ready to come and die with you if that's what it is. And we can understand that, can't we? In the safety of the room, among friends, it's probably quite easy to overestimate our resolve. But Jesus knows better. Verse 34, I tell you, Peter, before the cock crows today, you will deny three times that you know me. And here again, we find this contrast, don't we? Peter trusts his devotion, trusts that he has got the strength to do it. And Jesus trusts his intercession, his prayer. Peter promises great thing. I'm going to be there with you, Jesus. Prison, death, I'm there. And Jesus predicts his collapse, but also his restoration. And again, do we see how this is both a warning, that challenge, and the comfort? Doesn't it warn the overconfidence? As we look on at Peter and go, we'd have never done that. I mean, how could you have done that, Peter? He's even told you you're going to do it, and then you still go away and deny him? How could you possibly? But when we're saying things like that, doesn't that show that we're leaning on ourselves? Like any of us, given the right pressure and fears, could do things that we couldn't imagine today. The safe place here is not, I'm strong, I'm going to be okay, I'm going to stick with you, Jesus. But Lord, you know my weakness. Keep me. But it is also, again, this comfort for the failing. Jesus knew Peter on his worst night. He knew Peter even before Peter saw these things. And yet he still prayed for him, still claimed him for the future, and still said he was going to use him in the future. And again, if you're a believer, this is a precious comfort for us. Maybe you've fallen, maybe even fallen badly in some way. But your sin doesn't surprise Jesus. It grieves him, yes. But it doesn't stop him from praying. Again, the real question here is not whether you failed, but the question is whether you're again going to turn to him and ask for grace. Next one, please. I think it's number four, isn't it? A committed saviour and weary disciples. In verse 35 to 38, Jesus prepares his disciples for the coming hostility. He's saying, look, being associated with Jesus is no longer going to be socially safe. He's about to be treated as a criminal, and therefore they with him. But as usual, the disciples misunderstand. So they produce two swords. We're ready, Jesus. Here we go. Let's go. His it is enough probably isn't saying two swords is going to do the job. He's probably just like, oh, it's enough. Stop it. Stop talking. They are totally unprepared for what's coming, in contrast with Jesus. And I think this section here, Jesus on the Mount of Olives, I think it's probably one of the most fascinating and illuminating windows we have into Jesus' heart and indeed to the cross itself. And they head out to the Mount of Olives. The next slide, he tells his disciples, look, pray, stop here, pray that you won't fall into temptation. And he knows what's going to come. He knows what's coming, and he wants them to be alert. He wants them to be dependent. He wants them to be awake. And Jesus moves off by himself, and he kneels down, and he prays, verse 42, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." Here is the perfect servant at his deepest agony. And his agony is emphasized here. It's so great that in verse 43, we read of an angel coming to strengthen him. And yet, even with that strengthening, verse 44, "and being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground." Here is a man on the edge of what can be endured. His body is shutting down. Why? Well, it's because he's contemplating the cross. He's facing what he's about to endure, not simply dying. I don't think it's Jesus saying, "Oh no, I'm going to go and die." Okay, Jesus has been heading steadfastly to this moment from chapter 9. He's been heading to Jerusalem. But I think, what is it that is causing such distress? Well, the clue comes in his request in verse 42. "Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me." Take this cup from me. The cup is a common picture in the Old Testament, where the wicked nations who rebelled against God and were oppressing and inflicting misery on the people, they were going to drink the cup of God's wrath, God's anger at those things. So this cup is this picture of God's judgment against sin. And Jesus recoils from it. The anguish here is real. He feels the cost of what he is about to do. Not simply die, but as he's there on the cross to drink the cup, to drink God's judgments. And even as he feels this, he submits himself to his Father's will. He's yielding himself in full obedience. And then, having toiled away in prayer, having wrestled in agony with what about he's about to do, he comes back to his disciples, and instead of finding them praying, he finds them sleeping. Sleeping. They're so overwhelmed, paralyzed by their grief, that instead of praying, they kind of shut down. Again, do you see the contrast? Pray, and then they fall asleep. Pray, pouring out his heart and submitting himself humbly to the will of his Father. Theirs is the drowsy sadness, his and spiritual passivity, and Jesus, the greatest pressure is their praying and in humble dependence. But just to pause for a second, I wonder, perhaps you're newish here to church things, and you think, why is it they keep talking about this cross thing? Why are we talking about this method of execution? Why is Good Friday called Good Friday when it's someone dying on a cross? What is it? Well, perhaps here's the way to think of it, to use this language of the cup. Imagine you have the cup here, and every single one of your sins, you know, every time you are impatient with somebody, every time you fail to recognize God's goodness to you, every single thing, every heart attitude, every action, all the things that you failed to do that you should have done, and every single one of those, God's right and just anger gets poured a little bit into that cup. But it's not just yours, it's mine, it's everyone's his. Every bit of that just gets poured into this cup. And then on the cross, what Jesus was doing, as it were, is he was drinking that cup himself. He was experiencing God's just and righteous anger at all that sin and wrongdoing from his people, and he drank it himself. That's why we talk about the cross so much. Because what is the great news is that if Jesus has drunk that cup and he has drunk the cup of God's judgment, well, there's nothing in the cup. There's nothing left. Which means for you and for I, if we come to Jesus and trust in him, asking him for forgiveness and strength to live for him now, there's nothing to drink for us. It's gone. So here we see again that great contrast between the disciples and Jesus. One last contrast. We find a steadfast Christ and crumbling disciple. While Jesus is still speaking, Judas arrives, leading a crowd with swords and clubs. They come to arrest him. Judas betrays Jesus with a kiss, the most intimate of sign turned into a weapon of betrayal. The disciples, still thinking in sword terms, whip out the swords, we got you, Jesus, and one of them cuts off the ear of one of the arresters. And actually, what Jesus' last miracle before his death and resurrection is to heal one of the people who's come to arrest him. Jesus stops it, no more of this. And he speaks to the chief priests and the officers. You see from the middle of verse 52, am I leading a rebellion that you come with swords and clubs? That every day I was with you in the temple courts and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. Jesus exposes their cowardice, their hypocrisy, and yet he submits to them. He will drink the cup. He is steadfast. This is his path. But now we come back to Peter. Do you remember Peter, who so confidently in verse 33 declared, Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death. And yet, verse 54, Peter followed at a distance. He wants to be close, but not too close. I'm there with you, Jesus, just not too near. And then he sits down amongst those who've arrested Jesus. He's warming himself by the fire, and a servant girl recognizes him. This man, he was with him. Peter denies it. I don't know. A bit later, another one says, look, you were with him. He says, no, man, I was not. And about an hour later, interestingly, this is not just spread out over time. An hour later, another one says, certainly, you are one who is with this man Jesus. And Peter says, man, I don't know what you're talking about. And then immediately, while he was still speaking, the cock crows. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. That's got to be one of the most poignant moments of the gospel. Jesus over there being beaten and he's chained up over there and his eyes turned and he sees Peter. Jesus betrayed, arrested, mocked, beaten, interrogated. And he finds Peter, and Peter remembers the word of the Lord. And so he goes out, and he weeps bitterly, with his self-confidence utterly broken. The bravado's gone, and utterly crushed by his own weakness. Jesus stands firm, and actually if you were to read chapter 23, you'd see that very clearly. Jesus stands firm where Peter crumbles. But verse 62 is a horrible place to end. And he went outside and wept bitterly. But we remember this is not the end of the story, don't we? This isn't it for Peter. Because again, do you remember what Jesus had said to him early in the night? Yeah, he said you're going to betray me. But do you remember what he also said? I've prayed for you. And when you've turned again, strengthen your brothers. I think sometimes we can, as it were, get stuck in the courtyard as Jesus' people. We remember clearly, actually, that the moments when we've denied Jesus, you denied him in your words or perhaps in your silence. You remember the compromises. You remember that conversation at work where you've dodged the question. You remember that relationship where you've chosen sin over obedience. You remember those times when you've chosen convenience over faithfulness. And you hear the cock crowing in your conscience. You need to remember that if you are trusting in Jesus, Jesus has drunk the cup. And that look that Jesus gives you isn't the look of rejection. It's the look that cuts, yes, but it's to restore you. This is the same Lord who prayed for Peter and forgave him and later commissions him once again. Now, our failures actually can be a place of which God uses to strengthen us to serve others. So chapter 22 of Luke, it shows us this stunning contrast between Jesus and his disciples. We find the perfect servant, saviour, and his failing friends. And as these events, I hope, have held up a mirror to our hearts, and have also held up a window into his, Well, again, doesn't surely it do these two things? It humbles our pride. You know, we're not better than these disciples. Any confidence we have in ourselves is surely misplaced. But it also comforts us in our failures, that Jesus knew them at their worst, still loved them, still prayed for them, still died for them, still used them. And again, he is the same today. So our hope here this morning is that despite being like his disciples, we're still loved like they were, and that Jesus is surely enough for us in that. We're going to sing now. We're going to sing Man of Sorrows, a great song that captures what it was that Jesus was about to go and endure, drinking the